The next case is 0615, State of Ohio versus Betsy Brooke. Ms. Shepherd. I understand that exhibit, is this the case with the exhibit? No, next case is the exhibit, okay. Disregard my comment. Doesn't refer to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Karen Shepherd. I'm Assistant Prosecutor in Lake County, the Office of Charles Colson, and I represent the State of Ohio in this case, State versus Betsy Brooke. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Okay, watch your time.
Your Honors, I'm here today to ask this court to adopt a bright line rule. In cases across the state, prosecutors have been asked by the state legislature to utilize prior convictions, especially in the field of OVI offenses. Your ruling in this case will not only affect OVI offenses, it will affect domestic violence cases and also menacing by stalking type cases.
Ms. Shepherd, could you please move the microphone closer to you?
Thanks. We're asking the court to adopt a bright line rule that once a prior conviction is properly challenged, that proof of a written waiver of counsel executed by the defendant and filed with the court satisfies the state's burden to provide a valid prior conviction for enhancement purposes.
Is the case, it comes down to, doesn't in terms of the Court of Appeals, the burden on the prosecution?
There's a...
How much you have to prove, and that's it, right? You lose in this case, or lost in the Court of Appeals, because they said it was up to the prosecutor.
That's correct, Your Honor, and there's a burden-shifting aspect, is one aspect of the 11th District's opinion that we disagree with. With respect to the burden-shifting, the Carrion and Vales courts had held previously that a written waiver of counsel, a validly executed written waiver of counsel, satisfied the state's burden to do that.
Okay. So you want to put that in and then flip the burden back?
Correct, Your Honor. And there's an issue with whether or not the defendant in this case proved a prima facie case in order to shift that burden, and there is some discussion about that.
Would you agree if the burden on the whole thing remains on the prosecutor, you lose in this case?
No, Your Honor. Respectfully, I would not agree. Because in this case, which can be set aside from the many cases that were cited in both of our briefs, we have a written waiver of counsel. There's actually two different factual scenarios that this court can address. There are three prior offenses that were included to make this case a felony. Two of those occurred in the Chardon Municipal Court, one in the Willoughby Municipal Court. The two Chardon waivers are identical, and we have transcripts of that proceeding. The Willoughby...
And does the transcript indicate that the required exchange was done by the trial court?
Well, that's in contention by the parties. Obviously, they have to be treated separately. Two different judges conducted those hearings, and with respect to the first hearing in 1997, the court does specifically address the defendant, addresses her personally, even though this is a petty offense, refers to the fact that they need to review her rights with her in person, and asks her whether or not she wants to proceed with an attorney, provides her with the physical form telling her that she is entitled to an attorney or that she can waive that. She signs the form and it's filed with the court. With respect to the third case, which would be the second Chardon case, the court does have a colloquy with the defendant, the one I would have preferred in this particular case. However, there is a discussion about whether or not she wants to proceed with counsel, and there's actually a rather lengthy conversation with the defendant about what's going to happen.
So, counsel, in essence, you want a substantial compliance of the court's responsibilities in the colloquy and a bright-line test for the current situation.
Yes, Your Honor. They go hand in hand. With respect to the Willoughby waiver, and the waivers are reproduced in the state's brief on pages 18 and 19, although not to scale. The Willoughby waiver is more intensive. And in that particular waiver, the judge himself signs the waiver, and the judge himself attests to the fact that there is a waiver of counsel, and it's more extensive than the Chardon case, admittedly, with respect to what her rights are and the fact that she's waiving them. Now, the difference between the Willoughby prior and the Chardon prior is that there is no transcript from the proceeding. In the Willoughby case, yes, Your Honor. And that's where the difference comes into play and the issue of substantial compliance comes into play. Because when looking at the criminal rules 44 and 22, the question becomes, if we don't have a transcript, if we don't have a recording of that colloquy or of that waiver more specifically, because that case is, again, a petty case rather than a serious case, is the written waiver sufficient? And the state is asserting that, yes, of course, it is sufficient. Again, an important distinction between the class of petty offenses versus serious offenses. The first two prior convictions of Ms. Brooke in 1997 and 1998 are petty offenses. The rule doesn't even require a personal colloquy between the defendant and the judge. The rule doesn't even require that there be a written waiver, and yet we have written waivers in those cases. Now, with respect to the third case, it's a little bit different. But again, with the Willoughby case, what the Court of Appeals in the 11th District said was, well, there's a silent record there, and you can't produce a transcript, and the rule requires that you have a transcript. So,
well, didn't they say you didn't produce a transcript or a 9C statement?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the 11th put the burden on the state to produce one or the other.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I respectfully submit that any recreation of a plea hearing that was conducted 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago in municipal court in terms of agreement by the parties is never going to happen. That's just not a reality in these types of situations. What the state submits here is that we have something more than what the rule requires. We have a written waiver. We have an extensive written waiver. And when in any other case there's an absence of the transcript, or we have to presume the regularity of the proceedings. And instead of presuming the regularities of the proceedings and relying on what appears to be a validly executed waiver signed by the judge, signed by the defendant, and filed in this case, the 11th District turned around and said, well, you haven't strictly complied with the criminal rules, and therefore you can't meet your burden. And I'd submit to this court that that's wrong. With respect to substantial compliance, this court has recognized substantial compliance with the criminal rules, albeit in different situations, with respect to colloquies with regard to Rule 11 hearings. And those cases were even on direct appeal. If substantial compliance with the criminal rule carries the day on direct appeal, I'm asking this court to view enhancement cases even in a separate category. Competent ethical prosecutors, when looking to charge their cases at grand jury on OVI offenses, look to the previous cases. Do I have a certified valid entry of a conviction? Yes. Let's look in the file and see if there's a waiver of counsel, if they're represented by counsel. If they're not represented by counsel and there is an executed waiver of counsel in that file, the state should be able to rest assured on that point that they have a valid prior offense.
I guess the color, and I know we have case law that says we assume that trial courts conduct themselves pursuant to the rules and the statutes and so forth. But the colloquy with, I guess it's the Chardon judge here, seems to tell us that a waiver, a written waiver without more, without a transcript, is not really something that we can always put our faith in. Isn't that true?
Admittedly, that colloquy is not ideal, not the facts that I would have chosen to take to this court. However, I think this court can look at that case separately than the first
and
the second
prior. Well, except for writing rule of law here. Again, we're not, these facts are interesting, but they're the reason the case is here is because we've been convinced that there needs to be a rule of law. So we can't write a rule of law for one trial court and a different one for another one. Should we?
No, Your Honor. And what I'm suggesting is not that we put on blinders if there is a transcript. Obviously, all the evidence needs to be looked at as a whole. What's most concerning is in the Willoughby case, when there wasn't a transcript, there was a court retention policy that didn't require those records to be met, and yet we have a written filed waiver that in that particular case that we do presume the regularity of the proceedings.
So, counsel, what you're saying then is substantial compliance, if there is a record, coupled with a written waiver, should be sufficient to allow for those previous convictions to be used as an enhancement. And if there is a written waiver but no record because of court policy or retention policy, et cetera, then the lack of actual record should not be used against the state. It should be, the bright line test would, you can use that enhancement because there's no showing that the appropriate colloquy did not happen.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct.
Why should we not, as a rule, you mentioned that it would be difficult or it wouldn't happen that the prosecutor and the defense counsel would get together under Appellate Rule 9C opportunity that wouldn't happen. Why shouldn't we at least say as a matter of course that it ought to at least try to happen?
Your Honor, I'd submit to you that in most of these cases, there isn't even a prosecutor in the courtroom. That the vast majority of these cases occur between the defendant and a sitting judge. And as the legislature keeps expanding a look-back provision, it's becoming more and more difficult for the state to be able to produce as necessary documentation. I am not suggesting that in the absence of any record we'd be allowed to presume the validity of any kind of waiver. I'm only suggesting that in cases where we have a certified journal entry of conviction and we have a validly executed waiver of counsel, that be the gold standard by which prosecutors may be able to proceed to indict those cases.
I want to make sure I understand, when you're looking for this evidence of enhancement in a case like this, are you saying that we should write a rule that says the transcript must always be looked at by the prosecutor along with a written waiver? Or are you saying that the written waiver in and of itself should be sufficient?
The written waiver in and of itself should be sufficient, Your Honor. I'm not suggesting that we put on blinders and not volley the case back and the defendant wouldn't have an opportunity to raise issues based on the transcript. But in those cases, and there's a lot of them, where there is no transcript, we should, like in most cases, presume the regularity of the proceedings. And it's not on a silent record. I'm well aware that a silent record will not be sufficient to support a finding of a valid waiver. And I'm not suggesting that the least bit. But where we actually have a written document that's signed by the judge in front of the defendant, signed by the defendant and filed with the court, that ought to stand for something.
As I understand what you're saying is that you distinguish a record from the transcript. So the waiver is part of the record, notwithstanding there may not be a transcript.
Yes, and I didn't mean to confuse the distinction in those. The Criminal Rule 22 requires that in serious cases the waiver be recorded. The proceeding be recorded and the waiver, and in petty cases that the waiver itself be recorded. Now, if you look at that rule completely, the last sentence suggests that be, whether it's videos, stenographic, or audio type of scenarios. In this particular case, in the Willoughby court, there was audio tape that had not been preserved. There was a retention policy, I believe it was 5 years. This was some 6 years after the fact, and we didn't have anything. And I'm not suggesting that the prosecutor's office would be able to proceed with nothing, but the difference is that there's a filed waiver of counsel. And if that document alone is valid and without fault, then the state should be able to rely on that. I think this court can distinguish the Willoughby case from the Chardon prior.
In your expression of the acceptance of waiver, the last time through, you mentioned and signed by the judge. But you have one that was and one that wasn't.
That's correct. I'm sorry if I was misleading about that. The Willoughby waiver is signed by the judge. The Chardon waivers are signed in front of the judges, we can tell by the transcript, but does not have the court signature on it.
Oh, you would not make that a requirement to have a valid waiver?
That would be my correct answer here today. That's right, Your Honor. But there at least is an indication there, though, that it was done in front of the judge, and we can tell that by the transcript. The waivers have to be looked at independently. If that's all that exists, the waiver itself needs to be without fault, and I think the case law supports that. You know, absent some kind of finding that the waiver wasn't signed by the defendant, that there's two different waivers in the file, and one signed and one isn't, or that it's been altered, that's a whole different story. But if the waiver itself is sufficient and there's not any other record to indicate, the state should be safe in preserving that. In conclusion, we are looking for a bright line rule. We are cognizant of the need to protect the defendant's rights in these cases, but again, if we're to do our jobs properly and carry out the law, we cannot be relitigating hearings that occurred 10 years ago and be expected to do our jobs.
Thank you, Ms. Shepherd. Mr. Hurley.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the panel, justices, Ms. Shepherd. My name is John Hurley from Painesville in Lake County, and I have the honor of representing Betsy Brooke in this particular matter. Even though I appear on behalf of the presently prevailing party, I didn't come this entire distance to play defense. I believe, and I have argued at every opportunity, that the relevant law concerning the issues in this case is well established and of long standing. Such issues have taken on a current relevance, a particular relevance, because of the decision by the Ohio General Assembly to create a 20-year look-back period for purposes of enhancing the degree and the potential punishment for OVI offenses, without in any way intending to diminish the significance of the multiple OVI offender, I would respectfully request that this court not tamper with well-established constitutional provisions in this situation. The state would have the court set the bar as low as possible in order to validate as many prior convictions as possible. Betsy Brooke, because she did not have a stay granted either by the trial or the appellate courts, is in the waning days of her community service. The case still has some measure of relevance to her, but the case has greater relevance to those hundreds or perhaps thousands of John Does out there in the past who, for whatever reason, was, be it lack of funds, lack of ability to get away from work, lack of understanding, made a plea to a DUI, an OVI case, without the assistance of counsel.
Well, I would guess it would be of interest to her also, because the enhancement doesn't go just to sentencing, it goes to the crime. Is that right? Am I right about that?
Yes.
So that would be of some interest to her, I guess, to have a lower crime on the record versus a higher crime on the record, independent of the sentence.
I would agree with that. With that notion and that idea. In this particular case, my client filed a motion to dismiss based on the fact that the three prior convictions were uncounseled, and the matter was decided by a visiting judge simply on the paper. He did not schedule a hearing, he simply ruled based on what had been provided. My client, Betsy Brooke, supported her motion with an affidavit with two important ingredients. One, that she was in fact without counsel as to each of the three prior convictions. And secondly, that she was in fact sentenced to a period of confinement on each. And I believe the court can take judicial notice of the fact that there's mandatory confinement on every OVI offense. The state responded to the motion to dismiss by simply filing these three waivers of counsel forms that are duplicated in the state's brief. With regard to those waiver forms, I would note for the court that the content of them is disparate. The waiver form from the Chard Municipal Court is extremely terse in its content, and basically it says that I waive my right to have an attorney, private or appointed, to be present at the time of my plea or sentencing. It doesn't even contemplate or suggest that an attorney might be appointed to investigate, identify, and evaluate and prosecute a defense.
Counsel, it would seem to me that the most important thing a judge could tell your client or a lawyer representing her would have been unknown to both at the time, and that is pleading to these could have very serious future consequences because the General Assembly is going to pass a statute that says there's a 20-year look back.
I very much concur in that statement and that observation on your part. And ironically, there is some case law that says that the enhancing feature is not something that the court is required to inform the defendant regarding.
And it seems equally probable that many, if not most, folks who plead without counsel do so not because they need to get to work next Monday, but because they believe they're guilty. That would be another subset that you left out.
But as the court...
It would probably include most of the people that plead, wouldn't it?
As the court... the Supreme Court of the United States recognized as long ago as 1932 in Powell versus Alabama, even an educated man doesn't see the nuances of a criminal charge against him without the opportunity to have the input of counsel. So although that it could be a factor in many of these cases, it certainly is not the kind of thing that you want to set a rule of law.
So what more do you believe we should require the prosecutor to do?
Actually, you just...
To use these offenses.
They should simply comply with the law as it has existed since... since the Von Moltke versus Gillis case, which incidentally has been cited by and approved by this court in the case of State versus Gibson, and that is to demonstrate that the waiver by the accused was made with an apprehension of the nature of the charges, the statutory offenses included within them, the range of allowable punishments, possible defenses and circumstances and mitigation thereof.
Counsel, isn't that relating to felony offenses, however? The uncounseled pleas that your client is disputing relate to misdemeanor offenses. The language that you just quoted relates to felony charges, does it not?
Well, in Carnley versus Callahan, Carnley versus Carnley versus Cochran, the United States Supreme Court said that the determination as to whether an accused has intelligently and competently waived the right to counsel is applicable in state criminal proceedings. And the requirement that that there be an intelligent waiver of counsel applies to any offense where incarceration is a possibility or is in fact imposed, which includes obviously misdemeanors.
So counsel, would it be sufficient if all of this was spelled out in writing in a waiver form for you, theoretically?
I would say not, because of the requirements of the criminal rules, that there be a colloquy, that there be not only a waiver, but the advice of the court must be in the record.
So it has to come from the judiciary to the defendant, and an abbreviated waiver form would be sufficient for your purposes. Is that correct?
I respectfully disagree because of the fact that the rules require that there be a colloquy and that there be a record made of it. So a written waiver would not be adequate.
No, I understand that. But what I'm saying is that the contents of the colloquy need not be reproduced in the written waiver. An abbreviated waiver or a universal waiver form would be sufficient if the detailed that you just went through colloquy occurred on the record.
If the written waiver and the colloquy together meet the test, then the answer is yes. With regard to the idea that a written waiver is sufficient, there's case law that has held that it is not, particularly the case of State versus Dyer, which is cited in our brief. And the Carnley case, which I referenced earlier, held that presuming the waiver of right to counsel from a silent record is impermissible. Now, in this particular case, there were various degrees of record. In the Willoughby court, there was a written waiver, but no audio record retained. And therefore, there was no ability to evaluate. There was no colloquy to evaluate.
The Dreyer and the Brewer case that you cite to, one was Dreyer, I think, was second. Brewer was eighth. It found that there was a presumption against the regularity of the waiver, and yet the ninth, I think, we decided in Carrion that there was a presumption in favor of a valid waiver. Can you make a distinction or tell me why we should follow one or the other?
Well, I think the Supreme Court in the Brandon case has answered that question. They have placed the responsibility, that they've said that an uncounseled, the prima facie showing of an uncounseled plea flows from the fact that the defendant simply testified that it was uncounseled.
Yeah, that shifted the burden to the state.
Yes.
Yeah, but then the state comes forward, or at least as I understand the state's position, is they come forward with a document that says basically that I validly waive my right to counsel. So now I understand your position is that it's incumbent upon the state to go further than that because of the cases that said that a written waiver in and of itself is not sufficient, and the cases that say that silent record in cases of waiver of counsel is not sufficient. But don't we have a conflict at the district level, and why should we follow one rule of law rather than the other?
Because I believe the Dyer case comports with the federal constitutional requirements and the statements to a greater extent than the Ninth District.
And the state's position is that you didn't even need the original confrontation between the judge and the defendant in the first offense misdemeanor case. What's your response to that?
In order for the plea to be intelligently, knowingly, and voluntarily given, there must be the colloquy.
I ask you a question. Is it possible that the enhancement of the later, the charge that's here, Betsy's charge, as the trial court referred to her, that the enhancement could move the charge today from a misdemeanor to a felony if there are enough enhancements? I assume that could happen. Is there statute prevent that from happening, or is it feasible for that to occur?
I think that's exactly what did occur. Because of the three prior offenses, the fourth offense was charged as a felony.
There's no question that can happen. Neither of you seems to be challenging that. Wouldn't that be part of your, why wouldn't that be part of your argument that given the prosecutor's argument that, well, in a first degree misdemeanor, the one back in Chardon, the statute, the rules don't require this colloquy, but if we're going to enhance someone's penalty to a point where it's a felony later on, years later, 20 years later, 19 years later, should there be a different rule set for that? And do we have the authority to do that? I'm not sure we do, but it seems to me that the General Assembly here has adopted legislation that really looks good on the books, but it's quite impractical with the retention policies of clerk's offices and courts that we've got this gap as we have here with no transcript. And so 20 years later, many courts, unless they have to change their rules, I suppose, but their retention rules, but we're going to find this, I would guess, in a number of cases, are we not? You have an opinion on that?
Well, I made exactly that point in my brief, that the state makes the interim argument that how are we going to prove these cases in the 20-year look-back period, given the retention policies that existed? I would hope that their legislative history would have dealt with and recognized that issue and maybe guided them in a different direction, but it obviously did not. I see my time is expiring, and I will simply ask that the court sustain the ruling of the 11th District Court of Appeals. It's well-reasoned, consistent with existing law, and we ask that that decision be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Hurley. Ms. Shepherd, you may take 30 seconds.
Mr. Honor, with respect to the question about whether there should be a difference in looking back for enhancement purposes versus a case on direct appeal, I'd say that there is. These are convictions that have stood the test of time, that have been lying around unfettered for years. There was a conviction, there was a sentence that was carried out, and a loss of liberty had already occurred. There was no direct appeal, there was no motion to withdraw the plea, post-conviction relief, all those things are done and over with. And for all intents and purposes, this is a conviction that stands on this person's record. It can be used for a multitude of purposes, both judicial and otherwise. And then at the point where now we've done this three, four, or five times, and now we're facing a felony charge, the state is being asked to go back and check whether or not everything that happened previously was okay. Don't want to ignore the constitutional safeguards that are in place here, but the well-established constitutional provisions in place require that we afford an indigent defendant counsel in the face of loss of liberty, and that simply is not what happened in this case. We have three unequivocal waivers of counsel. There's no question whether
she... Well, but the Chardon one, if you look at it, as the appellee says in his brief, all the things that weren't said to Betsy, who has a problem, as he told her in court apparently, that she wasn't advised of hardly anything, was she? She said, I don't know what purpose a lawyer would do. Well, that's his point to say, hey, let me tell you, here's the list of things that every trial judge knows what to say. This trial judge didn't do it, so now we have a misdemeanor way back, and it's going to be a part of her. Back then, it probably didn't, it was the first time it didn't occur that I don't need a lawyer for this. But now she's got a felony because the state has said, this 20-year look back. Shouldn't we be a little sensitive about the substantial compliance? As you may know, I don't believe much in substantial compliance when it's clear what the duty is for judges and lawyers, but here we have another case, but this one doesn't even come close to substantial compliance, the Chardon one at least.
This is the most difficult, and the Chardon one, with all due respect, was her third prior offense. So at this point, she's had some experience in the courtroom. And with respect to substantial compliance and this court's opinion and other decisions with respect to harmless error and how we view that, even in a harmless error analysis, we need to look at prejudice to the defendant. In this particular case, the judge granted Ms. Brooke a sentence that was below the mandatory minimum, in fact, in this particular case. But I am not here to stand before you to suggest that that was an appropriate colloquy between the two of them. But I think that case can be distinguished between the first Chardon case and most definitely can be distinguished between the Willoughby case. these are not questions of waiver when you look at all the case law that we've cited in the brief where there's confusion. She's fired an attorney, should a new one be appointed? She's changed her mind, she wants a hybrid type of representation. She walks into court, says, I'm guilty, no doubt about it, no, I don't want an attorney, and she makes that additional effort to sign a piece of paper documenting that in front of a judge. And that should mean something, that should stand for something, and that should be sufficient. In the absence of any direct appeal, in the absence of any attack on that conviction, after she's already served her time or her sentence, whatever it was.
Now, let me ask you: do you anticipate that this is going to be a typical case for the courts where the transcript is gone? 20 years is a long time to keep a transcript on a misdemeanor, DVI or DUI, isn't it?
Most definitely. In this particular case, we couldn't provide a transcript after 6 years. I do see this as a case that's just going to proliferate. We'll see thousands of these cases.
Unless retention policies are changed.
And it'll still take a time to catch up. And again, though, never suggesting that in the absence of anything in the record that we should be able to proceed on these. But in those cases like the Willoughby case where we do have a very complete written waiver, that should be enough to satisfy the state's burden. And I'd also like to bring it to the court's attention that there was no request for an oral hearing in this particular case. There was an affidavit submitted, transcript submitted, the prosecutor responded, and there was no request for an oral hearing. I would also like to distinguish the Dyer case.
You need to sum up. Yeah. Your 30 seconds.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Your Honor. The Dyer case that was mentioned, that in that case, you're talking about a waiver which constituted a pro se defendant's motion to proceed on his own, and there was never any determination by the court. So that case is very different from Betsy Brooks' case, where we have, without question, three waivers of counsel, and there's not a question as to whether or not she wanted representation. Can't protect the defendants from themselves. People have the right to self-representation, and we shouldn't be going back 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years and questioning what happened back there where we do have a record and it comports with constitutional requirements. I'd ask that you reverse the 11th District's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shepherd. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.